Hi, you're listening to Switch On, a podcast to shape the principles of modern leadership. We will be discussing the real experience with successful leaders and learn from them how are they tackling real-life, real-time challenges and build on their learnings for tomorrow's success. In this series, we'll focus on how we are bringing vision to life. Having a purpose, a vision alone, is not enough to be successful. Both require action. Without action, vision is nothing more than a dream. The key to success is to stay focused and be realistic about the current situation and then learn perfect along the way. But as soon as we identify it, we need to start living it. The pandemic has highlighted what was already becoming clear over time, that hero leaders are no longer what companies need. The most effective leadership today isn't about technical expertise and having all the answers. Besides articulating a compelling vision, it's about being human, showing vulnerability, connecting with people, and being able to unleash their potential. Why? Well, the world has changed. Today's business environment is shifting fast, and it's increasingly unpredictable. No single person has a foolproof recipe to solve the complex challenges we're facing. Second, so people can give the best of themselves. People want to feel respected, listened to, and be inspired, not being considered like cogs in a soulless machine. They want to be seen, understood, and valued for who they are as individuals. And they want leaders who are human too. So I'm thrilled to have an expert guest with me today. An international conference speaker on the transformative power of HR, two-time TEDx speaker, award-winning writer on the future of work, a renowned blogger, and one of the most influential and progressive HR thinkers of this time. Betty Tins, the founder of People and Transformational HR, setting out to create better business for a better world. Welcome, Betty.
Welcome, Helena. Really pleased to be here. Thank you for the introduction.
Good to have you with us. Betty, your personal mission is to see more people flourish through their work and to help shift organizations as force for societal good, not just profit machines. Why do you do what you do? What drives you?
So in the UK right now, Helena, there's been a parliamentary vote about an MP who faced suspension for bribes, for lobbying, and it just proves how broken the political machinery is. So I think it's time for people to reclaim the areas of influence in the world. And as we see from the summit in Glasgow, there is absolutely something that's needed around collective people power. So I see that organisations who are there to service more than just a profiteering motive have a chance to do good, both in an environmental, communal, educational, legal, and even just and fair approaches to people's lives. So I think business will reclaim some of the agenda and drive purpose, and with the people who turn up every day to do that work, they'll see their higher sense of calling to it.
Such an important notion. According to the latest global talent trend study, before the pandemic, only 45% of the executives thought that their workforce could adapt. When they talked about agility, they meant actually two things: a flexible talent model and a diverse workforce with versatile skills. But when people work more than ever in a more complex environment than ever, how can organizations adapt to the changes in this environment of intensity and uncertainty?
Helen, I think that is the key question of now. And you've used the magic word in uncertainty, because I don't think we've ever faced such turbulent uncertainty in a long, long time. So not just the pandemic, but the convergence of all sorts of things like climate emergency, as I talked about, COP26 in Glasgow being discussed right now, but also just this realization that people have an enormous amount of untapped potential, an enormous amount of an opportunity to start to put things right in society, fairness, inclusion, and so on. So what does an organization do to capitalize on that and bring about versatility? So to me, the answers sound simple, but they are complex, as you pointed out. And I come back to a practice that I'm in, which is organization design. Most organizations in existence right now are designed for the industrial era of control at the top, of controlling mechanisms throughout, and of people with minimal influence being told precisely what they're there to do. And they are frustrated by the fact that they can see opportunities, they want diversification, they understand business has a bigger impact than just producing goods or services, but they're stifled from creating that challenge and change. And we are seeing some adaptations to that. So there are some organizations who stand in a more progressive space and who push through. I mean, there are some well-known brands who do it. Patagonia, as an outdoor apparel creator, they also stand for environmental consciousness. They are almost anti-capitalist. And so there is something about their approach to the world that has people going, hey, well, they can do it. So I think there's definitely something in the way organizations are designed that creates the conditions where we can be more versatile, we can deal with complexity much more readily, because the organization design of the industrial era was not built for that level of complexity.
Yeah, I fully agree. And you're so right when you say it's all about the people. And Gallup is actually closely tracking the engagement and well-being of the workforce today. And their report supports what we are experiencing. You mentioned part of it already. We are facing increased pressure toward ongoing growth, the continued need to generate enough profit, and the importance of the bottom line. On the other hand, people are being deflated. People who used to love their work have resigned. People are tired and are missing the light at the end of the tunnel. And according to the recent studies, when employee engagement goes up, the productivity goes up and the performance goes up, and the benefit far outweighs any costs. This sets an imperative that we need an environment that unlocks the potential of the people. How to turn things around? What do we need to consider when driving the necessary change?
I'm glad you pointed out the correlation and causal trail between engaged employees and people and organizational productivity and performance, because it is now virtually unquestionable despite where you sit on that spectrum, because engagement is a bit of an amorphous concept, really, because you can be engaged today because you're having a terrific meeting with a client, you've won some new work and it's full of opportunity, and you can be super unengaged the next day because your boss has just told you off that you could have got more out of that deal. So it really, really depends. It's a very fluctuating concept, and that's what I think is partly at its detriment to changing how organizations can and will design and act. But there is, as you said, light at the end of the tunnel, though. That's something I don't want people to lose sight of, because some recent research that was published in the Harvard Business Review from Yale and from a business school in Michigan has shown that purpose-led businesses consistently outperform in both operating economic sustainability, in its role in the climate and the ecology, and its consideration of care and duty of support for people. So it's almost like, you know, the economic case is really, really stacking up. And that's what drives a lot of businesses to change, because if they see their profits either diminishing or under threat, and they see more virtuous organizations creating a more circular way to continually invest, diversify, and be successful, they will change, they will adapt. And the Business Roundtable in the United States is a good example. In 2019, they made what appears to be a very symbolic gesture. And of course, the actions do need to follow from this. But they declared it is no longer about shareholder value, it is stakeholder value. And that includes multiple perspectives, multiple players, and multiple agendas need to be settled in order for a company to truly be successful. In the US, there's also an organization called justcapital.com. And what it does is a kind of NASDAQ Hang Seng type index. And what it does is it says, how is an organization performing, but how does it look after its people? What does it do for the community? How does it control its impact on the environment? And it then tabulates all of that data to create organizations that seem to be more caring, considerate, beyond profit. And my organization, it's only 15, 16 people, but we are now an accredited and certified B Corporation. And if you look up the concept of B Corporation, it's an organization that stands to do beyond profit and be good. And I see this agenda creeping up all the time. And you mentioned well-being. Every board I am aware of is saying, how are we doing on well-being now? Because they're recognizing just how much of a commitment they have to people, but how much cost and lost opportunity there is in talented people not being well and walking away from the organization, the great resignation, the great rethink, whatever you want to call it. So the tide's turning. Slowly but surely, people are noticing and are reporting and responding to measures like that.
Yeah. So true and very important that things are starting to change. And you have mentioned the necessity to change. And while companies go through transformations today and wish to build their organizational resilience and drive value, this demands change perceptions and change ways of working. The future of work is here, and leaders have the power to make it real now. So this makes me wonder, why don't they? What is limiting the progress and what needs to change so organizations can move forward with greater impact?
To that point, which is a terrific question, I think some of it is they are not suffering enough economic hardship at the moment to force them to change. So, for example, in the fossil fuel industry, there's still an enormous amount of investment coming through into that world from hedge funds. And there are still much of the world linked to and reliant on fossil fuels. However, green energy, Green New Deals, they're really starting to take off. So we are now a climate positive organization. OK, we're only 16 people, but we're doing our bit to show that if you invest in offsetting measures, you can show that actually you can have a climate positive effect on the world. Planting trees, use of solar power, investment in wind and hydro, and so on. And what will change this significantly, in my view, is when we get to a point that renewable energy is so abundant, those companies just will not have a value proposition at all. And they're sensing that already. So they are starting to adapt to green energies, as an example. So I think it is still economics that drives it. That's why a lot of them haven't changed, because there's no literal burning platform at the moment, but it will come. And then the other thing I think that's probably in favor of them is that people leading those organizations are frightened because they don't know what to do in that new environment. They're schooled and traditioned and experienced in the existing paradigm, and they don't know what the new paradigm means for them and how they can adapt. The good news is some of them can, most of them can. It's just will and intent and the ability to learn. Others are so stoic and stuck. I'm afraid they'll become casualties in the future with no opportunities. So people, I think, really should start to think about adaptation now.
Yeah, a very crucial period, but I think it's still time that we can turn the ship around and yeah, change something, even if this means step by step.
Yeah.
I wanted to take this opportunity also to discuss something else with you. This is also the time where the HR role is being transformed. In your book, Transformational HR, How Human Resources Can Create Value and Impact Business Strategy, you discuss the opportunities of this uniquely positioned role to prepare an organization for lasting success. Yet in practice, we still see a lot of focus on administration and operations, where people should come first. What is important when designing organizations where people can flourish?
It's a terrific question and a terrific observation of yours. And I feel very privileged, actually, to be part of HR and to be part of a growing group of people who recognize the difference it can make and the adaptations and changes it should and could take. So I think for a long time, we have been the sort of firewall, the security guard, the crash mat. We've been all those things for the organization, because the majority of processes and controlling mechanisms have meant that people who perhaps are on the wrong side of that and suffer perhaps some toxic management or some teams that aren't very well equipped and under-resourced and are under stress are just considered disposable assets and casualties so you can recruit more people. We're now starting to see that that damage is just not fair, just or appropriate. And so companies who are toxic and who are over-demanding are now getting headlines as really being organizations that, that should be ashamed of that practice. Something like Glassdoor.com is a great example where people can take to the social web and say, look, this company says this, but it doesn't do this. And it really lifts the lid on incongruent practice and a veneer of, I suppose you'd say, marketing and PR, when actually behind the scenes, it's not like that. And the Great Resignation is another example and illustration of this. So slowly but surely, people are voting with those choices. And I think HR's position is not to defend that anymore. It's to respond to that and go, hey, this is not right. I'm going to agitate. That's a word I use a lot. I'm going to steward some fairness and inclusion and equal practices here. And actually, during the pandemic, HR stock value has risen because of holding strong positions of, I would call them sort of semi-humanitarian practices to keep people safe and to keep businesses going. And suddenly leaders have gone, wow, HR really stood in a strong space for us there. The challenge now, though, is what do we do next? Because it's more complex, as you talked about earlier on. Now, HR's got a reputation for, in the nicest possible way, standardizing and simplifying things so that it is like a very sort of known practice. And of course, we're in an era where that probably won't suit the responsibilities and the changes that people are experiencing in their work. So my urge in the book is for HR to adopt more of the agile approach that we've seen in technology. Technology has gone from big, massive lumbering programs who don't really care about the user experience to the opposite, that everything is driven from the stories of the users who need to solve problems using tech, and it's built that way. So we need to build HR in a similar way from the person out, that then aligns to the organization mission. And again, I see it. Some examples in organizations like HubSpot, technology company, terrifically enabling people to be entrepreneurial, to be collegiate, collaborative, responsive, and they're not at all dogmatic and controlling. And that's a super successful organization. So tech as a product gives us a pattern, and even tech as companies give us the new rhythms that I think we're starting to see permeate through into healthcare, manufacturing, and all sorts of other ventures. So yeah, I think the pandemic has just accelerated what HR's capacity and capability is to influence change, and it is now time to reskill, step up, and really hold that space and forge strong alliances with people and strong alliances with leaders to create that flourishing environment. It can be done. I've seen it.
Mm-hmm. At the heart of your consultancy is the ambition to shape better business for a better world, where people can flourish through their work and shifting organizations, forcing societal good, not just the profit, as you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. How to get into this untapped potential from people?
I love this point, Helena, so thank you for raising it. When I go into organizations which are very well-known brands, hyper successful, very profitable, or very well managed in whatever area of industry they're in, private, public, non-profit, and government, etc. But there's also an enormous amount of waste, and waste is often in people being in roles that are not tapping into their full capability suite of skills and creativity. So I am starting to see some tension in the way we design job roles, for example, and how we deploy innovative practices in organizations. So again, it comes back to my point about design. If we can design it so that people have more space to both explore who they are and what they're there to do, and then what else, and then that what else translates into business value, that translates into loyalty, commitment, and adaptability, we see it. Deloitte have done some research on this in organizations over the last 4 to 5 years, and have seen a gradual disassembly of a functional hierarchy into strongly adaptable networked teams. Literally, people have taken it into their own hands and gone, there's a problem to solve. I need to bring some people together, solve the problem, plug a gap, or create value and opportunity. So whether we know it or not, or believe it or not, the hierarchy isn't everything, and the control mechanisms are being subverted by people who are brave enough to form into these teams to solve problems and create value. And I think lots of companies are leveraging that. ING Bank, as an example, has become more a platform than a financial institution, where teams work on products as if it were a technology venture. And so digital banking really is beyond the realms of what we've known before. So it can be done. It feels like a bit of disaggregation and disassembly, but that's actually at the benefit to people who can be more responsive to change, get more fulfillment, and learn more about what they're really there to do.
Earlier, you've mentioned that organizations need to become more agile. And when organizations are becoming more dynamic, facing daily new challenges, and these challenges are really complex, when work is done remotely and there is increased attention to technology adoption, the traditional leadership is becoming a bottleneck with communication, I agree, where command and control are perceived also as lack of trust while addressing these challenges. And there is a need for organizations to become agile simply to be able to manage, where people need to also feel safe so the different ideas can merge into productive success. What is your take on this, on finding the right balance in the environment where change is the only constant? And how do you bend the rules to create better work for everybody?
Yeah, and I, again, I've seen a couple of examples here. They both happen to be in the financial world, but they can apply to any industry that has, you know, a kind of a knowledge and service related element to it. But I've also seen them in manufacturing, so I'll bring a couple of manufacturing ones into play. But firstly, the financial ones.
Great.
Tangerine Bank was created in Canada as a management buyout from ING Canada. I mentioned them earlier on as a global entity, but Tangerine Bank was created, and the CEO there did two really incredible things. Firstly, he put himself up for election after his first year of being the CEO, saying, if you still want to vote for me, here's the chance, but you don't have to, because I might not have done everything you needed as an organization. And of course, they voted him in because by nature of declaring that, he was almost hopeful that people would back him, and they did. But then he made some really important changes, and he said, look, we are not going to be a functional organization. We're going to put customer centricity at the heart of what we do truly. And he proved this by a couple of methods. One was that when there was a new product launch, like an app for banking that Tangerine launched, he literally said to the entire organization, you stop what you're doing and you work on customer contact and helping people use this app. And literally, that was the priority. And it was really symbolic because you had people like the FD on the phone to people, helping them understand how to use this new app and so on. It's really symbolic. And then people went, well, this worked really well. So, for example, their corporate report, I saw a recent statistic from Harvard Business Review of a large multinational global organization where people spent 300,000 hours of their time supporting quarterly management meetings at the highest level. I mean, that's ridiculous. What Tangerine said was, right, when the corporate report's due, we want people to stop working on whatever they're doing and all come together and create a crowdsourced corporate report. And actually, people loved it. They're like, I can have my say. I can put my input to this. I can sense check what we're talking about as an organization. So I think, again, there's a classic example where people say, we're going to change by doing everything we can to be unorthodox and just surprise people and include them. The other example is in finance, Svenska Handelsbanken, who are a very successful Scandinavian and Nordic-based financial institution, but again, global footprint, famous because they don't have products. What they do is they say, every customer comes to us with a need. We're unlikely to have a product that suits all that need, so we'll build it for them. It's a terrific approach, and it wins incredibly strong loyalty from their customers. But what I love about them is that when they want to create a new branch, they don't go out and find a location where there's good footfall, good high economic relevance, and so on. They call out for a branch manager, recruit one on normally recommendations. If they haven't got a branch where that person lives, they'll create one. I mean, I think it's just so terrifically human-centered, it's unreal. And their returns per investor and deposits are terrific and sustainable. In manufacturing, I've seen it happen in the world of factory-based conveyor systems, a terrific company in the US called Barry Waymiller, who grow by acquisition. But they acquire companies not just for their products, but for their people and their cultural addition to who they are. Superhuman centric, super loyal, very responsive to change, and a successful multi-billion dollar industry focused on, we're not just getting products and a brand, we're getting people, and we need to look after them and learn from them and adapt our culture and enrich it. And I think that's a great example.
I love how you have mentioned that we need to actually focus on what counts and what matters. And current hybrid environment, when we have actually people together, yet they are not together, this yeah. presents a unique environment. Based on your experience, what is working and what are the common threats in this current hybrid situation?
So it's interesting because I saw some research only yesterday that talked about fully remote working versus fully in the office, and then hybrid is this kind of mid zone. And what's been early identification is that hybrid actually is slightly the worst of both options. And it's interesting this. So people are feeling a little bit tense, a little bit uncertain, a little bit more disconnected when their hybrid model hasn't been fully exercised and is clear to them. And I guess that's because the distinction between fully remote and fully office-based is much clearer, much more directive, and much more about perhaps choice and a longer sense of commitment to that particular model. And hybrid is so variable, I guess that's why it's perhaps reporting less than favorably at the moment. But what I think we are starting to see is if we talk seriously about an office, it really has to pass the test of what do people need to be there for. They don't need to be there to be at a screen. They don't need to be there to be simply in routine meetings that are repetitive and tick box and just about calibrating workloads. They need to be there because they need to bond with their people. They need to challenge some complex problems together in a kind of hive mind thought process, creative thinking, learning together, those kind of things. So I think that's what we're starting to see. So if anything, what I think is the emerging need is that the office is not a place where you just come and function. The office is a place that needs to be about cohesion, collaboration, creativity, and everything that sits in that space. And then the remote working options are clearly giving people choices about childcare, about walking the dog, about exercise, about healthy eating, but also come with a degree of separation and isolation. So we're 100% remote outfit. We're the most connected team I've ever worked with, and we don't spend any time together in person, but we compensate by using calls and chat and just such regular contact that we know who we are, how we feel, and what's going on in our lives. So you can adapt and adjust that. And of course, if people absolutely need to come together because the place they work in is vital, and I'm talking beyond offices now, utilities, logistics, healthcare, whatever it might be, then again, you don't resent those people who have choice. You're in that job because it's a job you add value to, and you recognise the conditions of it are physical proximity to other people. So we've just got to be clearer about the two ends of that spectrum and the choices and the real sense of purpose that sits in the middle of that hybrid variable option. So yeah, I think we're still working it out, and the early signs are we're clumsy and we're not getting there yet.
Beautifully put. Being agile means adaptability and creativity, like you have mentioned. And without it, we cannot become resilient enough for long-term success. Yet without trust, this would not be possible. How can we build trust in a virtual and transient digital teams? And how do you see this trust evolving?
Yeah, brilliant question again. So I don't think the emergence of trust is just based on pandemic and remote adaptations. The issue of trust has been around for a long time. I think we've always had perhaps the lack of trust in organizations because of the industrial age, hierarchical, controlling approach to it. It was amplified, though, when that was somewhat, I suppose you'd say, sort of stretched by the remote working digital first approaches we had to take, because it suddenly became more relevant. It's like screen-based spy software and constant calls just to check on what people were doing was almost like, you really don't trust me, do you? So when I was in a building and you could see me, you still didn't really trust me, but because I was there, you sort of had a tiny bit of faith in me. So again, I think it comes down to the construct and design and the sort of management principles and ethos. which is why I advocate so strongly for more autonomous and self-managed ways of operating. And that's not to say, yay, let's liberate everybody to just do what they want, because that's not what that's about. That is about, I know why I'm here. I know what to do. I want to get on with it without interference. And if I feel I need support or guidance or a decision, or I'm out of my depth, or I need to learn something, that's when I draw down management to help me out. I don't need management in position and interference. Yeah. So I think that's where trust has come from now. It's more obvious, and it's not going to go away. So we have to put in mechanisms which say, here's your outcome, and you need to deliver that, and you know that. You get on with it, and we will agree how successful you've been. We'll have dialogue. You can have my support, but I need to trust you to get on with it. So therefore, I'm going to do that. And then see how that goes. But we absolutely need more autonomy.
Yeah, it's about the empowerment and totally trusting your team that they can figure it out and reach that end goal.
Yeah.
To me, leadership is also about establishing the vision of the future, along with a great strategy and building a great culture that is driven by a purpose, as you mentioned, that motivates people to move forward together. According to the CIPD, the professional body for HR and people development in the UK, commitment to cultural change in an ever-evolving work environment is vital to maximize the benefits and ensure the commitment, engagement, and retention of their people. How do you see this statement, and how does this concept become a part of people's jobs?
Yes, I agree with this statement, because I like the fact that CIPD mentioned ever-evolving work environment, because I think we have to accept that. I mean, you know, I can remember change programs in the 1990s where people said, I can't wait to get back to a sense of stability, because that's what change was. It was, there was a bit of turbulence or misalignment. Let's change it and let's put it back into a shape that's solidified. It just doesn't work like that anymore. So we have to be prepared for what some people call perpetual beta, constant change, never the final version. Just live with that and adapt and iterate and continually improve it. So that's one way we can bring culture into people's minds, by saying there is no fixed culture here. There are cultural elements, and there are some artifacts that represent that, and there are some sensations and feelings we have and examples. But culture has been created over millions of conversations, and it needs to be adapted over the same course, millions of conversations. So how do we do it? Because you don't have a culture change program. That's my first bit of advice, because it's not a programmable device. So what you do is you say, we recognize there are some cultural elements here that aren't helpful to us, and we want to see them shift, and we recognize that's not through a learning program or some adapted structural environment. So what do we mean by good culture here? What does that manifest itself in? How do we call it out when it's not that? And how do we bring to life the bits that are going to enhance, enrich, and diversify our culture? And we keep talking it into existence. So instead of having a meeting saying, how are you doing on this project? Start the meeting by saying, how do people feel? What are you picking up from our culture? What's working well and what's not working well? And what can we do to adjust it in our team? And share that with other teams. And then the other teams share that with other teams. And before you know it, cultural infection becomes a good thing. So I think that's how we do it. And if leaders are not aligned to that, then there's some pressure upwardly to go, we're looking at the culture and we think there's a big shadow cast by you because of the way you do this. It's not congruent with who we are now. What are you going to do to change? Because it isn't what we need here. And I don't think there's anything wrong in stating that, because sometimes leaders are oblivious to that and they need to be told. So 360 feedback, no. Cultural commentary back about their shadow, yeah.
Yeah. True, but you need a really safe environment to be.
You do.
To be able to say that out loud.
You do. I think you build up to it. I think you create it at team level. The team level aggregates up to divisional level. Divisional pushes up to the rest of the organization. I think that's how you do it. Yeah. Don't go head on. Yeah,
for sure. Constant change requires us also to constantly learn, and to build our flexibility, we need to work on our learning muscle and become learners. What is your take on failure in the concept of learning?
Brilliant. I love it. So there is a very nice way to break down the word fail into first attempt in learning. So that's quite a nice way to look at it. Yeah. Yeah. However, I think there's a responsibility and a safety in failure. So, you know, I don't agree with the Facebook mantra of, you know, go fast and break things. Nah, it's not that. It's be responsible and safe, but be prepared to experiment in an adventurous and bold and dynamic way that might look like it's dangerous, but you contain it, you put it in a lab, you don't just do it in the open space, you know? So to me, learning is exactly what that needs to be. Learning is not programmed pedagogical teaching anymore. Learning happens all the time, everywhere around us. And what we need to do is be really deliberate about some of it. And that includes setting up prototypes and experiments that might fail, but you learn from it. Absolutely. I mean, the company WD-40 is synonymous with this, and they have what they call learning moments. So when people go, it didn't quite work out, it's like, okay, what's the damage? None. Great. But what did you learn? All of this. Brilliant. That's been worthwhile time. Let's see what that leads us to. And in fact, it's called WD-40 because the other 39 versions of it didn't work.
Good one. I really like how you say we need to be deliberate about it, deliberate about learning so that it becomes a day-to-day practice.
Yeah.
When you say business is about people, where the future of work is human, what is your vision for HR, if I may ask?
So the first thing I'll say is I don't care whether it's called HR or not. I'm not wedded to the title, but equally it's recognizable as a practice. So I'm not just in for trendy relabeling because people are still skeptical. So you can have brilliant HR and you can have absolutely terrible people and culture team. So, you know, it doesn't matter what you call, it's what you do. So in terms of the vision, I want and hope and can see the opportunity for HR to become this real catalyst inside the organization, where instead of experimentation and innovation only happening in research and development about products and services, it hosts brilliant ideas and schemes that employees and partners and collaborators come to HR and say, hey, if we change the way we work to this, we could do this more productively, we could do this more inclusively. So it becomes a place that incubates, and it becomes a place that stops just putting rules out, but creates a sense of what really good, committed, compliant behavior looks like and stands strong when people violate that. So I think it still has to have a stewardship role of fairness and equity, because sometimes people can be really quite harmful, sometimes without knowing, sometimes willingly. So it still has to be that. But I think it becomes more recognized for its incubation qualities about performance, sustainability, impact on community, fairness, humanity, and so on. It absolutely can be that. It just hasn't realized yet as a profession it should stand in that space, host, incubate, innovate, but hold strong on violations. I think that's exactly what we can be in the future.
Throughout our discussion, we have touched on the notion that we need more sustainable ways of working. It's time. How to engage the teams so they can do their best work, how to draw people in, how to liberate the people in order to create their future. What are your top three notes on this?
You've again hit the magic word there, which is teams. So my hypothesis on the future of work is it's not about organizations per se. It's about the focus on teams who, when aggregated, create the organization. Because at team level, it's easier then to see the individual need, nuance, subtlety, and flexibility. But it's equally easy to then see how performance looks and then aggregate that to organizational level. We've been trying to do too much macro, and we're flipping to too much micro when we need to do more meso. Sat in that is the team. So I think that's where we start. So as an organization, you declare that teams are the most important thing, and you're going to give teams autonomy, trust, support, belief to work things out themselves, what they need, what they do, how they're successful, so on. That's quite a symbolic gesture, because I think as a team, then you go, wow, we're like a little venture inside the organization. We've got control, we've got influence, we've got responsibility and capacity to do great things. Then I think from there, you then get teams to talk to other teams, and you get teams to become flexible, transient and versatile, so that team membership is fluid. And this is how people like Spotify do it and do it very well. Then what you need to do is be absolutely, massively obsessed with the data that comes from those teams to aggregate into what performance really is. And that means it's not just metrics and KPIs, it's sentiment, it's social, it's environmental, it's intellectual. Have a value scorecard that gives you 6-8 lenses of value, all aggregated up from teams. And I think people can see the impact they have in a number of different value streams. And then you get more commitment, more versatility, and more sense of achievement from people. That's my tips.
What a powerful conclusion and so many important takeaways. Change is a growth opportunity, and change means a new experience. It can be overwhelming and it can be intimidating, but there's no going forward without the change. So we need to embrace it and take charge of our change. Whatever our vision, together we have the experience and skills to be successful, to make our vision a reality. Betty, thank you very much for being with us and sharing your insights into what is the future of the workplace and what matters and what counts when evolving business for the better.
Thank you, Helena. I hope all the listeners out there are inspired and want to make some of these changes. We need it. And as you say, it's kind of inevitable. So let's go with it rather than resist.
Fully agree. Great to have you with us. This podcast is brought to you by Drop of Milk, an impact-driven business consultancy and expert on customer-focused digital transformation. You can learn more at dropofmilk.com.